The fossil fuel-based energy system has shaped capitalism and our geopolitical order. On this, our 50th year of existence as TNI, our flagship report unveils the corporate and financial actors that underpin this order. The dangers of an unjust energy transition, lessons for movements of resistance, and the possibilities for transformative change. How can we build a just energy transition in the age of corporate and imperial power? Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. In today's episode, a special accompaniment to the 12th annual State of Power report, Nick Buxton speaks to three interesting people who have unique perspectives on this question. Timothy Mitchell is a political theorist, historian, and professor of Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African studies at Columbia University. In 2012, his book Carbon Democracy, Political Power in the Age of Oil, retold the story of energy in the Middle East, showing how oil weakened democracy, fueled militarism and empire, and created a dangerous myth of infinite growth. Thea Riofrancos is an associate professor of political science at Providence College and a member of the Climate and Community Project, a left-wing think tank. She works primarily on the politics of extraction, particularly in Latin America and the US. Her upcoming book is Extraction: The Frontiers of Green Capitalism. Ozzy Warwick is the Chief Education and Research Officer of the Oilfield Workers Trade Union of Trinidad and Tobago and the General Secretary of the National Joint Trade Union Movement. He's also a founding member of the Trade Unions for Energy Democracy South, TUED South, a new South-led trade union platform dedicated to a public approach to a just energy transition. Nick Buxton is, of course, TNI's Knowledge Hub coordinator and founding editor of the State of Power report. Nick began by highlighting the link between the global energy system and how global political and economic power functions.
Well, thank you very much, Timothy, Thea, and Ozzy for joining us for this really important State of the Power conversation. We've been doing our examination of power relations as TNI in the global economy now for 12 years through our report, State of Power. And for the first time, it was interesting to me that the word power had a very much a double meaning: who has power over our systems, but also the power that energy gives us and the global economy. And I don't think that's a coincidence because, of course, energy is central to our entire capitalist economy and society. So the first question that I wanted to pose this initially to Tim was how do you feel our fossil fuel-based energy system has built up, which has built up since the 19th century, has shaped the way power is distributed today? And in turn, how has power shaped our energy system?
Thanks, Nick. In that book, Carbon Democracy, I made an argument that I can summarize in one sentence on the relationship between fossil fuels, power in the particular sense of fossil fuels, and democratic forms of power, which was that coal made possible mass democracy and oil set its limits. And the argument was that in the 19th century, when industrialized states became highly dependent on a single source of energy, coal, and particularly in the late 19th century, when that coal was used to produce electricity, and so energy was even more concentrated around the production and distribution of coal, workers had an unprecedented political power because for the first time they could shut down a country's energy system. And that power to shut down an energy system is what came to be known as the general strike. And it was called a general strike, but it was really a strike of coal workers, rail workers, dock workers, workers at power stations who could interrupt that supply of energy. And I argued that that was actually critical to the emergence of not the older forms of liberal democracy in which a few people had a voice, but mass democracy in the late 19th and across the first half of the 20th century. And then I argued that coal did that and oil undid it. And oil undid it because partly just came second, so then there was an alternative, and so it was easier to weaken that force of organized labor, but also because oil was different, being liquid, came out of the ground under its own pressure. You didn't have to send workers underground, and you could route it very easily through pipelines and oil tankers in more flexible ways that were more difficult to disrupt. And some of that power that workers had acquired through the energy system was lost, especially because oil also coming second developed in other parts of the world in the centers of capitalist industrial life, in regions like the Middle East and others. And that meant you opened up this great difference between those who were involved in the consumption of that energy and those who were involved in the production of it. And I think you can argue that that had a pretty profound effect, not only on the emergence of political forms in the late 19th, early 20th century, but that ability to undermine democratic politics in the second half of the 20th century, partly because energy was now produced in parts of the world where it was harder to organize, but also because where energy had made democratic organizing much more possible, even there it was weakened in the course of the second half of the 20th century. So there was a kind of de-democratizing effect of oil in the later part of the century. So that's a short answer to a big question about how fossil fuels have shaped some aspects of the ability of different forces to organize political power, contest political structures.
Thank you, Tim. Perhaps I could bring you in, Ozzy, because you, of course, have both worked and organized in the oil and gas sector. So how do you see this interplay of energy and the distribution of power through your own experiences?
Thanks a lot for having me, Nick. I thoroughly enjoyed listening to Tim's line of argument because I realized that maybe Tim has some experience in Trinidad and Tobago, because that's exactly what happened in terms of the emergence of an oil fossil fuel industry, which was coupled with the emergence of one of the most powerful unions in our country, which is the OWTU. And that union was instrumental in bringing about independence, for example, played a critical role in the independence movement, and it was oil workers coming out of the labor riots in the 1930s that gave rise to a sense of nationalism in terms of breaking from the colonial power structure. So the oil workers were bitterly not only nationalist, but they were anti-imperialist, they were anti-colonialist, and really laid the foundations for what would be an independent Trinidad and Tobago, which we got in 1962. So that is our experience, and so I think that the line of argument has weight in terms of our own historical development. Let me also just, you know, kind of sideways and say that when I reflect or think about the energy systems, I immediately sort of think of imperialism and the fact that the architecture of the energy system is actually similar to colonialism and empire, where you have this small concentration of power organizations that control the energy system itself. So you really cannot talk about the energy system without talking about power. So I think it's a very important question to start with, because you have to think of structures of power, the global relations of power, the institutions of power, and how that power is distributed coming out of global capitalism, which in turn, by the way, is driven by commodity production. And energy production and consumption drives the commodity production. In other words, the entire capitalist system of commodity production has constructed an energy system that gives rise to the global power distribution.
Thanks, Ozzy. And Thea, I was wondering if I could bring you, I know you've kind of particularly looked at also more recently about how gas, oil, and power has kind of intersected also even with kind of populist left movements within Latin America. So I was just wondering if you had your own reflections on this interplay about how our current energy system kind of really distributes and shapes power relations.
Yeah, so I was going to say something a little more historical, but I think it's on the same theme that you just prompted me. And, you know, I think that there's this kind of truism, and I don't mean that it's not true, but just that it once you think about it, it's quite obvious that, like, the structure of fossil capitalism is tightly interconnected with the structure of global power in an economic sense, in a geopolitical sense. You know, of course, I think Tim's book is very good about being specific about this complex interplay between empire and capitalism. Like, it's not neatly determinist, but regardless, quite connected, and Ozzy also spoke to that as well. I guess like another angle on that same kind of obvious truth that these two systems of global power and fossil capitalism are tightly connected is that there have been also very important challenges to that system that expose the kind of vulnerabilities, choke points, or weaknesses of that interconnection. And I was thinking first about the kind of late 60s, early 70s moment in which the then called Third World was starting to kind of organize amongst itself, right? So you have OPEC from the early 60s, you have a whole set of ideas around Third World resource producers like taking control over the resources that they produce, but like don't get the benefits of. And, you know, what's called in the West or in the global North, like the energy crisis of the early 1970s from the global South's perspective was like actually this moment of incredible opening and a power flex, you know, whether it was OPEC sort of pushing to increase prices or whether, you know, it was the idea of a new international economic order, which didn't get fulfilled, but, you know, still I think resonates as an idea. So I guess what I'm saying is like, I think of the early 70s as this critical moment where there was a kind of countervailing vision of how to reorganize global capitalism to like complete the project of decolonization. And that a lot of that hinged on like who controlled energy prices, production distribution. That of course was a short window in the sense that the reaction of the global North was intense and fierce, right? And I draw also on Garavini's work, and he kind of locates some of the origins of neoliberalism in that moment. And I think that accords with some of Tim's arguments as well. So that it was a short window, but I think a telling one in terms of, I guess that, you know, energy not just being a site of hegemony, but a site of contestation, right? And maybe just to conclude, but to bring it back to Ozzy, like, you know, what I've worked on in Ecuador and Latin America and elsewhere is like this really powerful idea of resource nationalism, which is not just an elite idea, though sometimes it's state actors that are, you know, elaborating it or putting it into practice, but very much an idea that emanates actually primarily from the workers' unions of oil and mining and extractive sectors, and also from, you know, broader kind of social movements and popular coalitions. But, you know, that idea of, you know, we should own the resources and the global North should not keep extracting from us. I think, you know, you just have constant contestation over that basic question that is actually quite relevant in our energy transition moment as well.
Thank you, Thea. So kind of bringing this, that's a useful kind of bringing some of the history from what Tim started with and from the 70s, but right now in today's world, I was wondering if you could reflect on, and we've had some, like you said, that kind of backlash to that resource nationalism. We've had the kind of rise of neoliberalism, the rise of big oil, and massive financialization of the world economy. So I was just wondering, in terms of kind of reflecting on where we're at right now, how central you see big oil and big oil in however you kind of imagine that to where kind of capitalism is today and to our kind of financialized capitalist order. So how key is big oil as an actor within our current state that we are in right today? Tim, would you have some thoughts on that?
The answer to that sort of begins from the moment that Thea was just talking about, which was indeed that period starting in the late 60s, early 70s, where the big oil companies begin to face this threat of nationalization. And initially they meet it by organizing coups and overthrowing governments, Iran infamously 51 to 53, but eventually they realize they can't do that and they have to give up control of the oil. And that's very much what that oil crisis around between sort of 1971, 1973 is all about. And we're living with a world that was very much changed once in countries like Saudi Arabia, now the very large producers, they took national control of the oil. So if you look at the list of the 10 or 15 largest corporations in the world, which in the 60s and 70s and even beyond would have included the six or seven enormous multinational oil companies, now the only large oil company there would be Saudi Aramco. The other half dozen would be, you know, Google and Amazon and Apple and so on. So there was a very significant change, and it's not just, of course, in Saudi Arabia that the giant Chinese oil companies, the Russian Gazprom, and other parts of the world as well, Latin America, this ability of state oil companies to assume that kind of control was that enormous threat from the 70s, if not earlier. So it's a different picture from the one we were familiar with, sort of talking about in the middle decades of the 20th century. That doesn't mean the power of those giant multinational corporations went away, but they were not playing quite the dominant role after the 70s that they were, or certainly after the 80s and 90s that they were before. They're still enormously large, enormously powerful. But I can't remember if you put it in your question. You were asking us before about how that intersects with the financial system. Is that part of what you wanted to? I mean, the two have sort of grown up together. Large oil companies, the large multinational oil companies, were the largest publicly owned shareholder firms, and they were always associated with some of the largest banks in the world. And so there was always a very close connection between international oil companies and large scale banking and finance. And that's continued to be the case on multiple levels. Again, it's shifted a little bit with the rise of other financial sectors apart from energy, but the two are closely connected. And I'll say this about the relationship between oil and finance, energy and finance in general. Energy is thought of as important to finance because it's enormously expensive. And so it requires enormous amounts of capital, and it generates extraordinary profits. But I think that's only one part of the story. The other part of the story of energy is that structures of energy production, relatively speaking, very durable. So you're building a financial apparatus when you build out some structure of energy production, which is going to produce revenue for decades, which is not often the case with many other kinds of industrial process. And it's the ability to capitalize that future revenue that explains the extraordinary value, the capitalized value of large oil companies. So it's not just because sort of the world depends on energy, it's a particular aspect of the scale and the durability of that energy production, so that the profits that are going to be produced can be translated into the current value of shares. But of course, that current value then becomes to depend on not just the fact that you look like you can guarantee making money for the next 20, 30, 40 years out of a particular oil field or oil producing country, but politically you can guarantee that. So, which is why you get an entire politics of energy security that then emerges around that. And that's as much a story of finance as it is a story of energy.
Ozzie or Thea, do you have something you'd like to add?
Yeah. Well, no, you can't really add too much more to what Tim said. But I'm just thinking, when I think of oil, big oil, one of the first modern multinational corporations was an oil company, was Standard Oil, in the late 1800s. And it drove significantly the expansion of imperialism. Oil played a decisive role as well in the run-up to and the outcome of the First World War. And after that First World War, you saw it was oil consortiums making agreements, right, with the British and French government as they carved up the old Ottoman Empire. And after the Second World War, global crude oil production increased fivefold, and it would have been a period as well of extensive capitalist expansion. And when I think of the intersection between oil, big oil, and finance, and I heard Thea mentioned it earlier, in terms of the 1970s, right? What they consider an energy crisis was really a financial crisis. So there is an interplay. And that crisis played a very critical role in the renewal of the United States power in global finance. Because after, in the end of the, they ended at that point, the convertibility of US dollars to gold. And there was strong intervention by the US to reclaim a major role in the reshaping of global finance through its powerful oil companies. We also had the phenomena of the reproduction of the petrodollar or eurodollar, right? Which enabled the flow of money from the United States multinational banks to non-oil producers in less developed countries. So there was this shift from institutional borrowing to commercial borrowing, which actually repositioned U.S. private banks, which would then go on to dominate the global finance sector as the U.S. oil companies dominate the global energy sector. And of course, I think, well, at least up to maybe 5 or 6 years ago, because we do, and we, I guess we'd be part of our discussion, see the rise of China and, of, as mentioned by Tim, the Saudi company. But in general, still, of the 10 oil giants, you know, 7 of them are U.S. and Brit and European. I could call it like a Anglo-European domination. Just 3 of them, 2 Chinese and 1 Saudi, but the rest are still Anglo-European dominated oil companies. So yeah, you still see that imperialist power structure still being persistent, even with the rise of other actors.
Indeed, fear.
Yeah, I'll just add a little bit. That was all really interesting. I mean, I think it's a very contradictory moment to ask this question in the sense that I think that there's going to be a lot of volatility in the finance fossil fuel relationship in the years to come, because we're in this early but still uncertain and very uneven energy transition, right? And you know, and so there's like contradictory things that are all true at the same time. Like on the one hand, what the IEA, and we could question the IEA, they also have like a whole kind of political and maybe even imperial agenda, but I'll put that aside. The IEA like forecasts that demand for fossil fuels is going to peak in a few years, right? Not supply, but demand for it, right? And like sort of plateau, it's not like going to drop off, but it's going to peak. And so that's one thing. So that might seem, oh, the fossil fuel industry is like in its death throes or something. But obviously that's not the case, because at the same time, we've had the most record, just like breaks your brain to think about it, profits for the fossil fuel industry in recent years, profiting in fact off of geopolitical instability and a number of, you know, and a number of other factors, but also the fact that there's growing energy demand and a lot of that demand is still fulfilled by fossil fuels. So regardless, so you have record profit, you have a demand that's peaking, but you also have record profits. And then on the other hand, you have these forecasts of like upwards of $1 trillion in stranded assets if the energy transition happens, right? Or if it, you know, picks up pace and we actually phase out fossil fuel use, $1 trillion. So that's an enormous hit to the financial system, given how much of that is backed obviously by investors. And then, you know, just to add one other piece, which is the rise of private equity and how much, you know, of that fossil fuel investment is being driven by private equity investor outfits that are more opaque, more difficult to govern even than a multinational shareholder owned firm, right? So there's just, you know, I'm just throwing in some additional components here, but I guess it is to say that the stranded asset question, I think, is going to raise the possibility of financial crisis, but kind of working against that is the fact that private equity is harder to govern and is going to continue to promote these projects, new exploration and extraction projects. And so I think the balance is a little bit uncertain, but maybe we'll circle back to stranded assets later, because I think they relate to a couple other questions, but just to kind of add those elements.
Yeah, indeed. And I think this does kind of segue into the next question, which is because we are in that moment of shifts, not just possibly the shifts of an energy system, but also shifts within the kind of geopolitical order. Although that's also discussed and debated. So I just wondered what, I wouldn't mind having your sort of thoughts and reflections on where you think energy fits into this kind of both the continued imperial dominance of the US, which you've been talking about, Ozzy, but also the kind of idea that there are new economic powers on the block, China, India, other countries in Asia, and how you see in this current moment the energy system shaping that kind of jostling for power.
I just want to go back just a little bit because I thought
sure, that's
Thea
fine.
touched on something that was, and she mentioned it, you know, in like one sentence, and it just had me thinking deeply, the question of private equity firms and ownership, right? Who really owns these companies? Because when you check their shareholdings, a large portion of their shareholders are actually just private equity firms. So, and I think the role that these firms are playing in finance capitalism is crucial, and they're often under the radar because, you know, they're not, how to put it, there's no identity to them. They're like these mysterious things. You just hear a private equity firm. You don't know exactly who they are or what they are, but they wield huge influence in terms of how investments are made, but also in terms of which direction capitalism will, invest in terms of new technologies and new systems of productions and so on. So I just wanted to again reemphasize that point of Thea in terms of ownership, private equity firms, and their influential role in global finance, but as well as with big oil companies.
Indeed, and I think we'll also come back to this issue when we look at the transition as well, because there's also we've had like BlackRock BlackRock making pronouncements and so on. So it'd be interesting to reflect on that then as well.
I'm gonna say one very quick thing in relation to Ozzy, and then I'm gonna actually add something and punt it to Tim if he wants to take it. So with Ozzy, one interesting irony here is this is not the only reason. Like, there's a whole rise of private equity and asset manager firms, and Brett Christopher's work is amazing on that. So that's its own independent phenomena. And they've been moving a lot into energy and infrastructure. And as you said, it's kind of this black box because they end up owning essential social infrastructure, and they're impossible to govern, and they just are turning this over in a vulture way to kind of eke out value out of it and then kind of sell it off or strand it or whatever it is. And there's this ironic thing, because one of many reasons that they've been acquiring so much dirty energy infrastructure is actually a result of the divestment of some pension and other institutional investments out of fossil fuels. So you have this kind of movement of this infrastructure, because some investors are divesting from it, it's like being bought up by private equity, which makes it actually harder to govern. So it's a kind of perverse outcome of an otherwise admirable, you know, move on the part of institutions and other investors. Anyway, just an addendum. But Tim, I'm curious what you think of this. I mean, when I think about oil and geopolitics and great power politics, like one development that seems to have thrown a lot of that for a loop over the past several years has been the emergence of the United States as the top oil and gas producer globally. Meaning, like, if, you know, the post-war era is partly defined by like US hegemony, including in terms of their scouring the world for energy resources and kind of like subduing Europe in various ways in that kind of quest, or whatever, to use that annoying term from a different author. Anyways, but yeah, so if, you know, there's this post-war era in which like US multinationals are very resource seeking, you know, they're going around the world, they're ensuring US energy security, so-called, like, what, you know, I have a couple vague thoughts, but I feel like you might know more, like, what happens in a situation in which like the US doesn't have the same relationship to some exporters because it's expanding its production so much to the point where it's, of course, like undermining some of its like ally, you know, Saudi, you know, I mean, there's this whole thing around price and production. Anyway, I won't get into it because you know much more than me, but I'm curious of how that's kind of scrambled geopolitics for the US to have, you know, so much of its own domestic production as well as exporting to the world and encroaching on others' markets.
Yeah, I agree. It's scrambled things, and you know, it's another of these elements of change beyond the rise of China and India, both of consumers of energy and particularly in the case of China as enormous producers of energy, of fossil fuels. And yes, the US, which had been the world's largest producer for many decades through the first half of the 20th century, and then after the 70s goes into decline, and then with the rise of of tight oil or fracking suddenly having an entire second life as an energy producer. And it has been disruptive because whereas under the old system, you had first the large oil multinationals controlling production in order to control price, and then sharing that role with OPEC from the 1970s onwards, to some extent, not always successfully. Once the US comes back as a major producer and most of that production in the hands of new or smaller oil companies, most of that new production, nobody's controlling the price. The old system that the US had for controlling price, the Texas Railroad Commission on which OPEC was modeled, was no longer functioning. So you had the largest, not just that the US returning to a position of being the largest oil producer, but returning to that position without the system of price controls that mm-hmm. had worked before under the system of either the Texas Railroad Commission or OPEC. So and the result of that has been this extraordinary volatility of oil prices. That, of course, is another part of this relationship and the same thing that Ozzy was talking about between finance and oil and the energy transition, which is that, of course, finance can make money out of volatility. It wants volatility to make money. And that's part of this story of private equity firms and buying up assets that nobody else wants, not because in themselves they're some long-term investment, but rather that rapid moving funds in and out of different kinds of investments allows you to profit from that kind of volatility and from that kind of unpredictability of the global oil order. And I agree completely with Thea that the return of the US as one of the largest producers has been a part of that.
And Ozzy, I know you've been, in terms of kind of non-US players, you've been looking at what's been happening recently in terms of the conflict between Venezuela and Guyana. So I was wondering what you think that reveals about the kind of both the energy system, but also the kind of geopolitical jostling and shifting that's going on right now.
Yeah, in doing so, I really want to put center stage the influence of U.S. big oil, ExxonMobil in particular. Now, first, just very quickly, the land dispute itself goes back to over 100 years in the colonial past when Guyana was British Guyana and Britain was trying to expand its imperialist influence. And Venezuela at that time, as you know, would have been an independent nation. But the issue itself sort of was more or less laid to rest. And then when Chavez came, there was an agreement with the then president of Guyana that, listen, we are not going to fight over this territory. We can work and develop it jointly. But in that period too, in 2006, Chavez government began a cycle of nationalization with oil at the center. And most multinational oil companies had accepted the new laws and regulations, except for two companies, ConocoPhillips and, of course, ExxonMobil. Both companies demanded tens of billions of dollars in compensation through the ICSID, the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. I think that's what it spells out, ICSID. But ICSID in 2014, and I'll pay attention to the timelines, right? In 2014, they found that Venezuela actually only needed to pay ExxonMobil $1.6 billion. And that infuriated Lex Tillerson. I can't remember his surname too much. I think Rex Tillerson.
Tillerson, yeah.
Now, ExxonMobil had signed a deal with Guyana to explore offshore oil since 1999. But here's the tip. So in 2014, this ruling came. And then Exxon in 2015 announced that they had found, all of a sudden, 295 feet of high-quality oil. And then they decided that they are going to begin drilling in 2015, after the ruling of 2014. And then when you look at the production sharing agreement between Guyana and ExxonMobil, ExxonMobil was given 75% of the oil revenue toward cost recovery, and the rest 50-50 with Guyana. And then they had an article called, it's Article 32, and it's the stability of agreement. Now, this is an agreement between what is supposed to be an independent nation state, sovereign state, and an oil company. But here's what the stability of agreement article says. It says that the government shall not amend, modify, rescind, terminate, declare invalid, or unenforceable, require renegotiation of, compel replacement or substitution, or otherwise seek to avoid, alter, or limit this agreement. Guess what? Without the consent of ExxonMobil. You see, neither the people of Venezuela nor the people of Guyana will benefit from ExxonMobil's political intervention in our region. We have always been a zone of peace, the Caribbean region, because as you know, Guyana is a CARICOM member state. We've always had a zone of peace, and we want to maintain that zone of peace. So to have ExxonMobil play this role, it's what it is really, is not so much a conflict between, and this is what I am positing, or I'm arguing, that this is not a conflict actually between Venezuela and Guyana. No, it is really a conflict between ExxonMobil and the people of these two South American countries.
That's really interesting, Ozzy, and I hadn't heard that analysis, so it's great to hear. I was wondering if, Tim, if you had any reflections on it, and I also wanted to, because one of the things I found interesting in your book, Carbon Democracy, was looking at how the oil politics had kind of shaped militarism, particularly in the Middle East, and in relationship to Israel and the 1967 war. And of course, we're right now in the middle of a new war with kind of genocidal impacts in Gaza. And I was just wondering whether you feel, if directly or indirectly, whether the war today has its roots with this system of both kind of carbon authoritarianism or carbon militarism that you talk about in the book.
Yes and no, more indirectly than directly. Definitely indirectly. I think the war on Gaza, has its causes, you know, quite simply in an Israeli state that wants to dominate completely the area of historic Palestine and not tolerate any kind of Palestinian demand for national rights or any other kind of political claims. And that's the reason for the conflict and for the scale of the violence that is being inflicted. I think where those larger connections to geopolitics, oil, come in is that, of course, Israel couldn't get away with that without the US on the level of financial support, on the level of supplying the bombs that are being dropped, and on the level, of course, of the political support, repeatedly vetoing calls for a ceasefire and so on. And there are particular reasons in the US political system and the influence and the propaganda system that Israel is able to organize to maintain the support of the US government for what it does. But I think there's something wider that keeps that going, and that is U.S. militarism itself. And U.S. militarism, whether in places like the Caribbean historically or in regions like the Middle East, are very much tied to the history of oil, and too often understood in simplistic terms about the American need to defend vital resources. I think the militarism and the spending that US does on its armed forces, I mean, you know, here's a country that spends 50% of its discretionary budget on the armed forces and on militarism more broadly, spends more than the next 10 largest military powers in the world on that. And it can get away with that, and it can get away with that in an ostensibly democratic political order because it's able to generate this sense that somehow security is at stake. And I think that's where the relation to events like Gaza or early history, previous histories around Iraq, around Afghanistan, around Iran and so on, constantly to generate that sense that security is at stake and that somehow energy is central to that, sustains in a vitally important way this form of militarism that sucks up this extraordinary amount of not only a budget, but an entire economic system in the US. So, you know, it's not directly that to defend oil, the US has got to, you know, be on Israel's side. It's part of that larger system of militarism.
Thank you. And I want Thea to kind of take the conversation from the kind of military to more the ecological sides of this question, because I know you've worked on these issues. Our current energy system is clearly leading us to ecological climate collapse and threatens the survival of a huge amounts of our planetary biodiversity. So I was wondering if you could kind of explain why you think our energy system is so destructive and also why it's proved so difficult to kind of change course. Why are we so wedded to a system that is so, so destructive?
I think that probably the second is better for me to answer than the first part. Like, why is it so destructive is more, you know, a matter of climate science and physics and, you know, material reality in the sense of, you know, we use an energy source that releases greenhouse gases that stay in the atmosphere for hundreds of years and do untold harm to humans and the planet and disrupt, you know, the all kind of biophysical systems. That's on the kind of atmospheric or planetary level. And then of course, there's a lot of localized harm and pollution on both the extraction end and also the consumption end, in the sense that combusting fossil fuels doesn't just release greenhouse gases far away into the atmosphere that cause planetary scale climate chaos, but also in the immediate pollute particulate matter, and that air pollution is itself a major cause of human death and suffering. So that's my short answer as to in what way it's destructive, though probably a scientist could answer that better than me. But, you know, why is it so difficult to change? I think, you know, gets into deeper questions of politics and power, and also just the kind of mechanics of the capitalist system that are maybe a little more germane to our discussion. I mean, one I mentioned already, which is this phenomena of stranded assets, you know, which is the fact that when a fossil fuel project, if a fossil fuel project were to be abandoned, a specific fossil fuel project, because as a society, we are phasing out fossil fuels, that project then becomes a stranded asset in that all of its future revenue stream and profit, you know, evaporates, and it just becomes stranded and actually a cost to the investors. And so, you know, with any extractive sector beyond fossil fuels, including mining, et cetera, this is an issue because there's a lot of high upfront fixed and even sunk capital costs. And so you're making the bet that over sometimes decades that you are going to, you know, get a return on that investment. But in the immediate term, it's a cost. And so if you never get that return, it's just a cost, right? And so you could imagine that owners of fossil fuel assets are going to be incredibly resistant to transitioning the energy system, even if there are opportunities for them to profit in the new energy system, which there are myriad such opportunities. But the issue of stranding their very valuable assets is of a more immediate concern. And given the imperial and just very politically influential and connected kind of history of the industry and present, the owners of those fossil fuel assets are very well positioned to coordinate amongst themselves and delay and deny and all of the things that we know that they have done and that have been revealed in tons of books and investigative reports. And so, you know, that's one way to think about it, is stranded assets and the political power to ensure the ongoing profitability of their assets. Maybe I'll just name two other things. I mean, another is we could, and I'm kind of taking this argument a bit from Andreas Malm and a sort of broader collective that he's worked with, and to think more generally about the just and maybe this even harkens back to our first question, but like just how deeply imbricated, even beyond energy, when we think about petrochemicals, the plastics industry, just like the materiality of capitalist life is just so deeply imbricated with the substance that, again, it's hard to, you know, some people then say it's hard to imagine the end of oil without imagining the end of capitalism, right? So we get the idea that the stakes are very high and that powerful actors are going to delay transitioning and losing their power. I guess I just want to bring in one final point here, because I think all of what I just said is again, sort of fairly obvious, though worth discussing. You know, I think there are other reasons that it's hard to change our energy system that don't only have to do with the interests of the most powerful, but also have to do with the interests of less powerful people. And so I mentioned, you know, are we in the pre-discussion about low and middle income oil exporting countries, right? Like one that I studied, Ecuador, but this could apply to many others. It's, you know, I continue to be surprised in a way that there is just absolutely no plan and no discussion in the sort of centers of institutional power about what's going to happen with countries whose entire fiscal basis is tied to oil revenues and who like cannot provide social services, public infrastructure, just like the basics of governance or you know, just daily life for their people without those revenues, right? And so I'm not saying that it's Ecuador's fault that or Nigeria's fault or whatever it is that we're not transitioning. All I'm saying is that in addition to the interests of the most powerful fossil capitalists and their lobbying group, there's this difficult reality that transitioning away from oil would deny a crucial revenue stream to a number of poor, low and middle income states. And that is, I don't know whether to call it an obstacle or just I'm not sure what to call it, but it's certainly a challenge to the transition that needs to be discussed as well.
And that, of course, very much relates also to Trinidad and Tobago. So I was wondering, Ozzy, yes, your thoughts on the ecological impacts and why it's been so hard to transition from this form of energy from your own experiences.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Thea raised a concern that is critical for I guess, small oil and gas exporting countries like ours, right? I mean, we have, our entire economy has been based on oil and gas for a very, very, for many, 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 many decades. I mean, it still account for almost 60% of our GDP. And therefore, it becomes a real challenge in terms of during this period of transition, you know, what happens in between? So, if for example, we are engaged right now in a struggle for a progressive just transition in Trinidad and Tobago. We are actively involved in that struggle. We have been mobilizing our membership to give power to those of us who are now trying to steer the government away from what is in fact a neoliberal transition. They call it a just transition, but it's not, there's nothing just about the transition. It's just a transition. So we've had thousands of job losses. I mean, tens of thousands of job losses already. And there's no new jobs that was promised and that was supposed to be part of this just transition. What they're doing is actually commodifying and privatizing more and more public utilities like water, electricity. We are facing right now an increase in electricity rates come next month, for example. So one of the struggles that we have is when governments talk about a just transition, I really feel that it's nothing more than a cloak to conceal what is in fact a new wave of structural adjustment programs. And I say this on the basis of what we are experiencing right now in Trinidad and Tobago. And I think, therefore, that in the absence of a very concrete alternative approach, what will happen is that there, under the cloak of the just transition, you have neoliberal policies that will be implemented, but at the macro level, for example, in Trinidad and Tobago, they just signed a gas deal. So whilst they are doing a transition, a just transition, and jobs are being lost, and you have the marketization and the commodification of utilities and of social services, whilst that is happening, you sign new gas deals. In fact, you already announced the increase of drilling workovers, increase in production of oil exploration. So that contradiction is a dilemma that we're dealing with. And I know that it's a dilemma that majority, if not all of the small export oil and gas, fossil fuel export countries are going to face in real terms. How, for example, we are faced with a situation where our national insurance, which is the entire national social security safety net, is under threat of collapsing. And therefore, if we are doing this transition, how is that going to be financed? And who will be, and the people who will be most impacted are going to be ordinary poor people. So we already have to face the ravages of actual climate change. And then at the same time, we are going to face huge social disruptions as a result of an unjust transition. And finally, on that point, the other thing that we have to contend with is how do we protect ourselves from green imperialism, from a green capitalism, for example. The government announced that they are going to have this deal with, guess who? BP. To, in effect, take complete control of our transition to renewables. So those are some of the, you know, real concrete things that we have to struggle for in terms of this period.
Yeah, indeed. And I'd like to come a bit back, swing back to the question around what a just transition would look like and what it can look like. But I also wanted to ask the question, and also, Tim, if you had any comments on the broader question about the kind of link between the energy system and its ecological impacts. I remember in your book, you talked about the, in some way, oil kind of gave this idea of a kind of limitless growth, which I think is very much embedded in this. But also just, there's a question now about, are we in a transition? And I just wanted your thoughts on that as well, because from our research that T&I, other T&I colleagues have done, it very much looks like really we're talking at the moment just about a near an energy expansion rather than energy transition. And as Ozzy shared, very much a kind of neoliberal energy expansion. So what's your take on those thoughts?
Yes, I did write in Carbon Democracy about the relationship between the history of oil in particular and conceptions of growth, the very conception of the economy as this object that grows. And it's interesting to think about those questions and how tied up they are, you know, our entire modes of economic thought in a set of ideas about energy and its expansion and its future. Between expansion and transition, I mean, I tend to say we're in both, in the sense that there continues to be an expansion in the use of fossil fuels. And even as I think Taya mentioned, the International Energy Agency sees that continuing at least through 2030, after which it anticipates merely a peaking or a plateauing and then some decline. So that's, you know, continued growth in the use of fossil fuels. It's unevenly distributed, I think, partly because of some of the factors that Ozzy is talking about, you know, the green imperialism, the privileged access to renewables themselves, and certainly to the technologies that underlie renewables, means that in some places the transition is so much easier, including the point he made that if your current financial order is based on oil production, then the challenges faced by the transition are that much larger. And, you know, that's the reason why, in fact, many of the most highly industrialized countries have transitioned further. There's, you know, I believe in most European industrialized countries, possibly even the US, fossil fuel consumption is lower today than it was in 1990. And of course, the continued expansion is mostly happening elsewhere. And that does reflect the fact that for certain countries, finding the capital to invest in the transition, to invest in extraordinarily expensive offshore wind or utility scale solar is an awful lot easier. So, but that is happening, and there are tipping points which have happened quite recently in the relative cost of renewable versus fossil fuel sources of energy. It just takes a while for those tipping points to work their way through the system, which is why, you know, it's not happening fast enough to meet any of the targets for 1.5 degrees of warming, and why we're going to very soon have overshot that. So, to answer your question, yes, I think it's both an expansion and a transition, and that it's happening differentially in different parts of the world, and that the people impacted by that in the ways that Ozzy very cogently pointed out are enormously different.
Thanks, yeah, I'm just going to add a little bit to that, if that's okay. You know, I think that, and I also agree about the important point that one reason it's so uneven is the different kind of fiscal and investment capacities of different states. And I guess I want to emphasize, and I'm influenced by a new and really good book by Brett Christopher's called The Price is Wrong, that I really recommend to everybody. But anyway, you know, where one of his key arguments is that the low and uncertain profits of renewable energy. So Tim mentioned the high capital costs, right? So that's one side of the equation. They're costly. Building an offshore wind farm is an extremely high capital cost endeavor, especially in our current environment of higher interest rates and more constrained kind of finances. So there's and bigger and higher material costs. So that's to the point where in the UK and in the US, these wind developers are actually pulling out of contracts that they previously signed because it doesn't pencil out anymore. So on the one hand, you have these high capital costs. On the other hand, the actual profit of those sectors is low and uncertain compared to fossil fuels, compared to other possible investments, right? And these are investors looking at different investments, right? And so they're thinking about differential profit rates across sectors and projects. And so to, you know, what that means concretely is that government subsidy is very important. And that subsidy can come in all sorts of forms. You know, Daniela Gabor talks a lot about de-risking. So like, you know, kind of underwriting the risk. It can come with, you know, active tax credits, tax abatements, offsetting of capital costs, cheap loans. And a global South country cannot do that. I mean, they like a global North country, and really especially the US, which is like even far beyond its European peers, has the ability, and China, but for different reasons, both have the ability to use public finances to offset these capital costs. And even in the US, that's totally insufficient, it's turned out, to get, like, you know, enough of an energy transition going. But, and so maybe we should analyze China separately. But I guess my point is that there's a way in which these capitalist sectors are very dependent on public de-risking and assurances of profitability. And that's one, yet another reason why the investment is so unequal, because not every state has the fiscal capacity or even the freedom, right? Like the Global South is very constrained by the IMF, by its loans, by its creditors in doing public investment, right? Putting aside whether we think states should be underwriting private profits, that's like a separate and big question. But let's just bracket that. Like, if that's the way the energy transition is happening, there are states that are simply being told in so many words, like, you can't have an energy transition unless you really de-risk, really deregulate. I mean, do these really extreme neoliberal measures to attract investment. But it's at least I've become convinced that's a big issue in terms of why the transition has slowed a bit, and why China and the U.S., again, for different reasons, kind of stand out in their ability to sort of underwrite it.
And Thea, I was wondering if I could just follow that up with, because I know you've also been looking in terms of not just the exclusion of countries from this transition, but also the ways that the transition can exclude workers or the producers of transition minerals. And it's something that Thea and I has also been grappling with, you know, how do we invest in a transition, but without a kind of model of extractivism that kind of repeats the same models of extraction of wealth, but also extraction of ecologies, entire ecological systems, and particularly in the Global South. So just to hear a bit about your reflections on those particular challenges of a just transition and how that is kind of part of the picture right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sort of different angle on it, but, you know, what, on this question of the energy transition, looking kind of upstream in a way at the kind of mineral inputs of the renewable energy technologies, which there are a lot of. There's like a whole periodic table of elements that are like newly considered critical or essential, you know, cobalt, lithium, which is what I work on. The U.S. just added copper to its list of critical minerals, rare earths, cobalt. I mean, we could graphite. I won't keep going because there are so many. And all of these are essential inputs. You know, there's, and they raise a lot of concerns. May be some opportunities, but I think also a lot of concerns and dilemmas for Global South producers of these so-called critical minerals. I mean, one is, I think, compared to oil, and we were talking about Trinidad and Tobago, 60% of the GDP tied to oil, and I was saying something similar at Ecuador, compared to oil and just the sheer size of the oil market, especially in the sort of long 20th century, these minerals, because there are so many of them, and there are, each of them is just a part of the kind of input question. And so it's a little hard to imagine like a country sustaining itself on lithium revenues, just because, again, like the size of the market compared to oil, like with copper, like Chile and Peru and other countries, copper instrumental to their fiscal kind of situation. But with a lot of these other elements, the markets aren't huge, and yet at least they're growing, but they're much more dispersed. So like it's, you know, I guess that what gives a Global South country leverage in terms of extraction is like it's a large market that the world depends on, and a lot of it is concentrated in that country in terms of the reserves. Where with this periodic table of elements, some of which are actually distributed and found in many countries in the world, I actually think that question of producer leverage becomes a little bit more difficult. So that's just to relate it to our earlier conversation. But you know, what is definitely clear is that transitioning away from fossil fuels, if that's what's happening, is not a transition away from extraction, because a whole new kind of set of extractive sectors are becoming relevant. And each of them have a lot of ecological and social impacts, and also labor exploitation, of course. And mining is just, you know, an industry that, while it doesn't have the same carbon footprint as the fossil fuel industry, it has like a tremendous amount of localized environmental and social harm associated with it, and also has one of the worst records in terms of human rights violations. I think it's agribusiness and the mining sector kind of compete for that, you know, nefarious kind of title. And so in terms of where people get killed or where workers get repressed with the most brutal violence, like it's those sectors, right? So the idea of expanding them in order to furnish these renewable energy technologies, as necessary as they are, solar panels, lithium batteries, et cetera, is concerning from a human rights, governance, and eco-social kind of perspective. Yeah, I mean, I could say much more, but I won't, because this is all I think about. But, you know, I'll add one quick piece and then I'll turn it back over to other people, which is an interesting tension or contradiction with these critical minerals. Is that, you know, on the one hand, I absolutely agree with what Ozzy said, and I think maybe Tim said something similar about kind of green capitalism, green imperialism, that we see a lot of reproduction of neocolonial relations in terms of acquiring these minerals, in terms of the places where the worst environmental, human rights, and labor impacts are. And so that's a familiar story, and it's unfortunately like very present in our contemporary reality. There's something else happening at the same time, though, which even relates to what we were talking about the U.S. as a major domestic powerhouse of oil and gas production, which is the global north saying, actually, we want these mines here in the global north. And so there's been this whole trend, which I've worked a lot on, of that's called onshoring, where, you know, the U.S. government, starting with Trump, but much more under Biden, has decided, like, we don't want to rely on these volatile supply chains. We want to have lithium here and cobalt here and extract it here. Now, on the one hand, we could say that's globally just, because, like, the U.S. should pay the ecological social price for all of its extractive needs. But when we look closer, it's, like, not necessarily so just, because, first of all, the extractivism in the global south is continuing apace. Like, it's not displacing it, because the whole demand pie is growing. Second of all, when we look at who's affected by those mines in the U.S., it's like indigenous tribes and Latino, you know, rural Latino communities. Like it's similar vulnerable populations, but within the kind of, you know, imperial center, but these kind of peripheries of the US are where these mines are being located. So I think that kind of complicates the picture a bit. And then on the third hand, like, now it's kind of even more problematic for Global South mineral producers, because they're now competing with the US for investment, which is like a crazy scenario, because the US government can just underwrite these mines, and it is. It's offsetting capital costs. It's passing all of these, this legislation to give tax breaks to mining companies. So now, like, you know, if you're Ecuador or Zambia or Peru, like, and you're trying to attract mining companies, and not that that's a great route to development, but that's just the reality with, you know, whatever means that they have at their disposal, now you're kind of competing with the global hegemon in that game. And so it's just, it's complex, but it's quite interesting, and I think shows a lot about current kind of geoeconomics in a way.
Thank you, Thea. You captured a lot in a short space. I'd love to hear, Ozzy, your thoughts on this, because I know you're involved in particularly how workers are experiencing the transition, and what it means for workers, because I know you're also organizing to like what a just transition would look like. So what's your experience in Trinidad and with other labor movements that you work with?
Yeah, well, just to say, in Trinidad and Tobago, we are experiencing an unjust transition. I'm very clear. And it reflects to that contradiction of both expansion and transition. Because as I mentioned earlier, we are still signing new gas deals. We are still signing new oil production contracts with BHP Billiton, Shell, BP, still very active and exploring new fields as we speak. So, and in the reality is too that the jobs that are left are jobs without terms and conditions. Meaning that the jobs that did exist prior with collective agreements, which had fairly decent terms and conditions, that is now gone completely. So the entire, so there's a transition in the sector, not along ecological lines, but along economic lines, meaning that a transition from decent jobs to precarious jobs within the energy sector. So it's almost as though there is a reversal back to the 1930s and 40s when workers had absolutely no rights in the energy sector. So, I mean, that is something that we are indeed grappling with. Now, I want to just sort of sideways to the work that we have been doing with Trade Unions for Energy Democracy, TUED. And it's a very important work, because what that is presenting is an alternative to what I just mentioned. And it is framed along what is called the public pathway approach, which really attempts to show ways to get us from here to there through an extension of public ownership of energy. The public pathway approach that we are working with TUED is really a proposed set of programmatic commitments that will improve the chances of a new political economy emerging in the coming decades, but one that is consistent with the hopes and aspirations of many of us who've been working in the social movements, in the trade union movements and the social movements. The evidence of history has made it clear that the current energy expansion is inseparable from capitalist expansion. And I think Tim and Thea showed us that very, very in clear terms. And this is what is driving the climate crisis and the breakdown of the world's ecosystem. So that any serious attempt to decarbonize the economy will require, in terms of transport industry, heating, cooling, food and agriculture and so on, will require lots more electricity, even if energy conservation and efficiency are dramatically scaled. So it therefore follows that any viable and effective means of curtailing the energy expansion and mitigating it, the climate impact, must involve taking control of how energy is generated and used. This is a main tenet of and central to the public pathway approach. Control of energy is critical given the technical realities and also from the perspective of political strategy. So the struggle for energy can provide a clear focus to, for us in movements to strive for radical systemic change.
Thank you, Ozzy. And that's where I wanted to take the conversation as we're kind of running over a bit. But I, in terms of just, and to hear both from you, Tim and Thea, about as we strive for this, a public pathway for a citizen-led, a worker-led, more democratic, just energy system, what are some of the issues that we need to grapple with? What do we need to change about the energy system and from your own perspectives and thoughts to kind of accompany some of what Ozzy's described and which networks like TwoEd are trying to advance?
Well, I think I don't know that I can add to what Ozzy has already said, because I think the example he's given of the organizations he's with and the way these problems are being framed is exactly both the challenge but also the opportunity of these moments. Mm-hmm. What seems so distinctive and what he shows us so well is the understanding that, you know, energy is not just a technical question of providing a certain number of gigawatts or whatever. It is where our politics is being organized and is at stake, and where questions of justice and social justice is at stake. And I suppose, you know, that's actually a very different situation, perhaps, than at various moments in the past. And perhaps there's something quite promising in, you know, the scale of the transition that we've got to go through, but also the political awareness that it is not just a technical question. It's not just a question of counting quantities of carbon or assessing the relative technologies. It is precisely a site in which political struggle is already happening and can be encouraged to happen. So it's fascinating to hear Ozzy talk about the work that he and his colleagues are doing. And that seems to me absolutely, you know, certainly the lesson one would want to bring from this discussion.
Thank you, Tim. Thea, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, just I think two points probably. One is circling back to something I was saying earlier, which is about the hesitance of capitalist investors to invest in renewable energy because of this issue of low and volatile profitability compared to other investments, which then kind of leads to this public subsidization of what are really privately owned infrastructures in order for them to happen at all, which then I think raises the question of why not cut out the middleman, so to speak. I mean, meaning if the public purse is already subsidizing and having to pass major legislation, like in the US, the Inflation Reduction Act, in order to get any of this transition going, why don't we think about direct ownership? You know, whether that's ownership of the generation capacity, ownership of the wires and cables of distribution. I mean, in the US at least, our energy system is a bit fragmented. So there's different parts of the system that could be publicly owned, or they could all be publicly owned. We can even, and I've worked a lot on this, Ozzy as well, and I've worked with TwoEd, you know, on energy justice and energy democracy campaigns. I think there's a lot of innovative strategies. Recently in New York State, really important legislation was passed, led by socialists and even specifically eco-socialists who have been organizing around this for years, and it happened to get this kind of state-owned entity that owns generation capacity to actually kind of empower it to buy more renewable capacity and to help decarbonize public buildings. So there's a lot of interesting campaigns there. But again, I do think this question of ownership is critical now, because it's very apparent that we can't rely on the profit motive to decarbonize as quickly as the climate science demands. And so that's one answer. The second, and again, to this point of labor unions and labor militancy and the role of all of that, I think there have been some very interesting developments. I mean, Ozzy raised several, but, you know, in the US a few years ago, we had an important development of the United Mine Workers, you know, who represents coal miners, finally officially endorsing a just transition, which is critical, right? Because I think one of the big things with a just transition is how do you organize workers to kind of see themselves as wanting a transition and wanting to organize around it so that they benefit from it, rather than allying with their bosses, right, in delaying the transition and being scared of it, right, which is, and it's been a real thing in terms of energy workers in the US. And so the United Mine Workers, coal workers, saying we embrace a just transition and we're going to organize for it so that it's on our terms has been, was a good development, and maybe even more consequential in terms of their economic weight and leverage. Recently, we had this major, very important, very militant and creative strike organized by the UAW, United Auto Workers. And that's not in the energy sector, that's in the auto sector. But a big reason for the strike was to make sure that workers are in the driver's seat, I guess, pun intended, of the EV transition, because the EV transition can work out all sorts of ways for workers. There's a lot of fear of layoffs, of automation, of the fact that there's concerns that EVs are less labor intensive than ICE vehicles, though that's disputed, but workers understandably fear that. And just like Ozzy was saying earlier about oil workers, we've had this trend of just precaritization of auto work and moving to non-union states in the US and this whole other story. But the point is that the UAW decided to be a protagonist, and they actually, and under much more radical rank and file kind of inspired leadership, they won. They won tons of amazing contracts that ensure that battery workers and EV workers are going to have, you know, the same kind of standards as the traditional auto work. And I think it's just an example of what can happen when unions organize less on the defense of like protecting jobs in dirty industries and more on the offense of like, we want to shape the kind of renewable energy transition. And I think at least that's a starting point, not to say that it's still a very asymmetric battle with the corporations and bosses, but I think it lends itself to more power for workers ultimately.
Ozzy, we lost you. You have the final word, yeah, if you can hear us. We have a lot of readers of this publication who are involved in energy struggles. We're up against very entrenched systems of power. So I was wondering what your message is, both to those involved in these energy struggles, and where are the points of action, the points of transformation, the points of possibility that you see from your own experiences, and just any final thoughts.
Wow. Okay. Well, I feel deeply honored because I've been enjoying so much Theo and Tim. I mean, I learned a lot. I was actually taking notes. I really thank you all for this experience. It means a lot. And I wanted to use as the springboard for my message, more or less, is that last year we launched 2ED South, and that is important because that is where the unions of the Global South is saying that there is an alternative, and the public pathway is a legitimate, it is a plausible alternative to the existing sort of privatized to decarbonize approach. And my message is that we must never stop demanding system change, never. The demands for system change are what constitutes, in our view, a really just response to tackling the climate crisis. When we transitioned to capitalism, it had a negative impact on the environment. So what is required is to transition out of capitalism. For the vast majority of countries, and especially in the case of us in the global South, without strong and progressive interventions from the public service sectors, much of the intentions to reduce the emissions will not be possible. So an effective, progressive, just transition will require a well-resourced public service sector. And the struggles around the world have shown us that it is still possible to make a difference, and that there is still the opportunity to believe that human society can transition and be reorganized to protect our planet and at the same time protect the livelihood of those who inhabit it. That would be my message.
That's perfect. Thank you, Ozzy. Thank you all.
Thank you
so much. That was
brilliant. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI's Knowledge Hub coordinator, Nick Buxton, and Timothy Mitchell, Thea Rio Francos, and Ozzy Warwick. Do make sure to read their contributions in TNI's 2024 State of Power report on energy. The link is in the podcast description. TNI's material is all free and has been for the 50 years of TNI's existence. We would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do for the next 50 years or more. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from, and to please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.